Welcome to this first podcast produced by the Integrated Translational Health Research Institute of Virginia, the iThrive, which is an NIH-funded clinical and translational science award, otherwise known as a CTSA, and it's formed as a formal collaboration among the University of Virginia, Virginia Tech, Carilion Clinics, and Inova. iThrive is a virtual research institute which facilitates clinical and translational research by investigators affiliated with these centers. Part of the iThrive mandate is to support and promote scientifically sound, rigorous human subjects research. And as one small part of that effort, we'll be producing a series of topic-focused podcasts that can be listened to by investigators. This is the first such podcast, and it is focused on rigor itself. What is it? Why is it important? And how do we get it? I'm your host for this series, and together with my co-producer, Jan Balmer, we'll be delivering this series over the term of the iThrive Award. I'm Jim Nataro, MD, PhD, MBA, and I am the Benjamin Armistead Shepherd and Chair of the Department of Pediatrics at UVA. I am joined today by Sarah J. Radcliffe, PhD. She's Professor and Director of the Division of Biostatistics and the Associate Chair for Research in the Department of Public Health Sciences, and she's the Director of the iThrive Research Methods Core. I'm also joined by Karen C. Johnston, MD, MSc, and she's the Harrison Distinguished Professor of Neurology and the Associate Vice President for Clinical and Translational Research. She's the director and the PI of the iThrive CTSA program at UVA and Virginia Tech Carilion Clinics and Inova. We're also joined by Richard D. Stevenson, MD. He's Professor of Pediatrics and Head, Division of Neurodevelopment and Behavioral Pediatrics at UVA. And he is the medical director of the UVA Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, and he's the chair of the Institutional Review Board for Health Sciences Research at UVA. Welcome, everybody, and thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to start with the most basic question. So what is rigor after all? And I think I'm going to start with the definition of rigor that we find on the NIH website, and that reads, scientific rigor is the strict application of the scientific method to ensure robust and unbiased experimental design, methodology, analysis, interpretation, and reporting of results. So that's a mouthful. So Sarah, why don't we start with you? What is scientific rigor and why is it so important in clinical research?
I think the short answer is scientific rigor can be summarized as good experimental practices. It means we set up some type of protocol before the start of the study that we adhere to throughout that explains what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. And the importance of it is to ensure that we have reproducibility in our research.
How can you tell when rigor is there and when rigor is not there? I guess we'll be talking about that more over the next few minutes. But when you're looking at a protocol and you're trying to assess rigor, what kinds of things are you looking for?
I think I'm looking for is the question that's of interest well-defined. It's not just saying this will improve this, but exactly how are things being defined for improvement. It's also looking for what might go wrong in a study, and are you already planning for how you're going to mitigate those effects on your results?
The iThrive is also supposed to promote scientifically sound research, and I couldn't find such a strict definition for what is sound human subject research. Is there a difference between what is sound and what is rigorous?
So this is Karen. I think of sound research as kind of high quality research, and you can have high quality research that does not maximize those tools that we use always in rigor. There may be specific situations where you have a trial design that because of either a specific population or because of a certain intervention, you are limited in the number of those rigorous tools that you can use in that design. So an example of that might be a trial with a surgical intervention. We know that ideally, to be the most rigorous, we would have a double-blind study where the patient is blinded and the study team is blinded, but when you have a surgical intervention, it is very difficult to blind the patient. So that's an example where we would change the design to maximize how sound the research is, but it might not have all those components of rigor that we would ideally include.
Now that we sort of understand what's rigorous, what's sound research. It sounds pretty easy, right? So everybody should be able to provide the most scientifically sound, rigorous human subjects research. But what are some of the challenges that investigators face? And Karen, we can start with you on that.
So I can tell you some of the things that we hear from investigators at iThrive. We hear a lot of investigators coming to us looking for the resources that they need to maximize the rigor in their research. So finding resources, I think, is one obstacle. Another thing that we find is that investigators often don't recognize their own biases in their research program. And so having a collaborative team that has expertise from lots of areas can be very helpful. So we will often help investigators find the collaborators that will help them maximize their research program. One of the things that Sarah mentioned already is a big obstacle, which is that often once you start your research program and initiate your protocol, there are unexpected components to what happens with your research program, and often researchers don't know how to manage that unexpected component. So thinking ahead of time about what may happen differently than you expect is a really valuable part of what we can help investigators do.
iThrive then being available to help during the planning and design of the study, but you mentioned a very important word, bias. Bias sounds to me like the arch enemy of rigor. So you want to tell us a little more about what are the some of the sources of bias and what bias does to your science?
So this is Sarah. I'll answer it from a statistical point of view. Those biases can show up in results and what we'd think of as cherry picking of data. If the data results don't match what you think the answer should be, trying to say, well, this is an outlier or this is unusual, there's something wrong with this point, in order to try and make it look like you thought it should look like at the start.
And there are sometimes systematic biases that we build into our studies without even realizing it. For example, recruitment bias. If we recruit our patients only on Tuesday and a certain clinic only happens on Tuesday, then those might be the only patients that we get in our study. So again, having statistical expertise, design expertise to make sure that everyone on the team is thinking about what the potential biases are can be really helpful.
It might be helpful to chime in here about the perspective of the IRB. You know, the job of the IRB is to assess, is to protect human subjects primarily. And a big part of that is assessing risk and benefits. And a big part of the benefit has to do with answering a scientific question. And if the quality of the research, if the rigor of the science is not such that you get an answer in the end so that you have generalizable data, then you are potentially placing subjects at risk without getting the benefit of generalizable knowledge at the end. So it's really important from the IRB's perspective that the science is sound and rigorous enough to answer a question. Because in the eyes of the IRB, bad science is unethical.
I think the word validity might be a good one to introduce at this point also, talking a little bit about whether or not the data that the study generates are actually generalizable or applicable to real life, to the state of nature, as you could say as a scientist, right? So what exactly is validity and what's the relationship between that and rigor? Sarah, you want to start with that one?
The difference between, you know, validity and rigor is what we're going with. So I would say that you can have a valid study without necessarily being very rigorous or vice versa. So the validity needs to be answering the question of interest within the population of interest. And so you could have a very rigorous question, the very rigorous protocol that does not actually answer the question in the population that's at risk. Or you could have something that has a very valid answer to a question, but it's not the question you wanted.
So validity includes generalizability, right? As Rich is talking about, generalizability to the population that you're looking at. So a valid study is not only good sound science, but also it's going to be applicable to the population that you really care about.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So Karen, I think as you first mentioned the word bias, you were also talking about an individual investigator's bias and how having multiple investigators, having a team, can reduce an individual's bias. That's kind of an interesting concept. And, you know, we don't always think of what we bring to science as scientists, sort of, you know, there may be a difference in one person's worldview or what they expect to generate in a study and how that might actually impact what you observe and then how you interpret it. Do you want to say something about that?
Happy to. So it's not uncommon, especially for junior investigators, to come to a research program with a lot of assumptions based on their biases. And again, that's the beauty of having a collaborative team. If you can bring experts from multiple areas of expertise, again, including our statistical experts and potentially our data science experts, they can often sit with an investigator and explore how to maximize that design and eliminate those biases so that the question that's being asked can be answered in the most clear way possible without those biases.
All right, so putting myself in the place of a relatively new investigator, let's say, and I'm putting my study together, and Rich, as the chair of the IRB, has already sort of told us what the IRB's after. So is that a good place, Rich, to make sure that I get off on the right foot? Is the IRB sort of there to help me design a good protocol with control of my bias and with good validity? Or is the IRB sort of a watchdog that's ready to snap me up?
The IRB is actually views itself as being a key partner in the conduct of ethical and effective and rigorous clinical research. The IRB is always available for consultation at any point in the development of a protocol. And I think one way that the IRB can be helpful early on in the process is in really talking about the potential protocol and what the investigator wants to do and some of the human subjects issues that might sway the investigator one way or another in terms of perhaps the study design or what might be feasible for their particular project. So, for example, in assessing the risk, you know, sometimes investigators don't necessarily think about risk right away, and the potential risk for a subject might change how the investigator might approach a particular project.
Does the IRB have a checklist or some sort of tool? Is there one of, maybe iThrive has one that investigators can use in preparing their protocols?
The IRB has many checklists. And the IRB tries to help investigators by guiding them using some checklists and some other tools to kind of move towards a protocol that can then be assessed fairly and efficiently. And putting together a protocol using our electronic systems will guide the investigator through a series of steps to create a protocol that will then help them decide and help the IRB decide whether this is a study that could be exempt, that is no risk, could be expedited, that is minimal risk, or would require a full board review, which would be greater than minimal risk. And each of those protocols are different in terms of the extent to which one needs to describe the study.
iThrive Now, new resource for investigators. Karen, so where does one start? A lot of investigators will be very excited to make use of the resources. If you're conceptualizing a protocol, starting to pull things together, maybe you know about the IRB. So how do you first interface with iThrive?
So one of the beauties of iThrive is we're trying to simplify the collection of resources to make it easier for the research user. So instead of having to run around the institution or around grounds or across the state to look for your resources, people can now go to the iThrive website, and on the iThrive website, they can log in to the iThrive portal. And there are a series of pathways you can go depending on what it is, what information it is that you're looking for. And those resources are there for you to explore right on our single portal web-based system. Now, if you don't find what you're looking for in that web-based system, we also have a research concierge team led by our research concierge manager, and she does individual consultations with folks to help them find the resources they're looking for. So I think having iThrive resources available to researchers will at minimum make it much easier for them to find the resources that they need to do the most rigorous research.
Statistical help. That's a lot of investigators are not statisticians, and they get intimidated by maybe continued growth and complexity of appropriate statistical design analysis and analysis. And we know that if you don't have good statistical analysis, that clearly it can diminish the rigor and validity and ultimate success of your clinical trials. And frankly, I know from my own colleagues that statistical, shall we call it intimidation, actually discouraged some people from being investigators in the first place. So do we have ready access to help? And maybe Sarah will let you start with this and, you know, help us dispel the math anxiety here that I can feel out there in the airwaves.
So let me start with statistics is fun. We have a number of different ways that people can get statistical help. First of all, 5 days a week here at UVA from 12 noon to 4 p.m. in the library, the Health Sciences Library, we have a drop-in service called PHS at the library where we have master's level statisticians who can answer your questions immediately for free. Then we also have you can find us through the portal or on the PHS webpage, there is a form to request more extensive collaborative support. And there's a number of mechanisms for supporting that, both free and with a small fee, depending on what mechanism you're using. If you go through the portal, though, you actually will get linked up also to similar services at Virginia Tech and Carilion Clinic. So there is drop-ins available across multiple of our iThrive sites, and we are happy to help you. We love statistics, and we will help make sure your design and analyses are correct.
So I can add a couple things to that. I agree with you that statistical support is probably the primary thing that we see researchers looking for, but the iThrive team offers additional resources that may be really helpful to investigators as they start to develop their research programs. Number one, we can help them find collaborators. So there's an opportunity for us to connect different collaborators with folks if they need a data scientist or they need a statistician or they need someone with certain clinical or technological expertise, we can help them connect. We can help with both design and statistical analysis, as Sarah has mentioned, but we also do feasibility assessments with folks. We have new software that we are sharing across grounds and across iThrive that allows investigators to assess whether it's even feasible to identify the cohort that they are looking for in their human subjects research. And then the other thing that we think with investigators about is the openness of their methods. So the data and methodology sharing, again, that transparency piece that makes sure that we're all thinking about the reproducibility of the work that we're doing. And that's another thing that has been relatively unfamiliar to many of our researchers.
So if you come up with a good idea and maybe you go to iThrive and maybe they're sort of telling you that the study has to be a little bit bigger than you thought about, is there any help with identifying potential funding sources?
Yeah, so there's a section on the iThrive portal that does help with both identifying sources for funding as well as proposal development. So we also have folks on grounds that can help you write your grant once you've identified your best sources for funding. So these are all resources that are worth exploring.
So I what I'm hearing then is really good integration between the iThrive and public health scientists and Cisco resources. So it sounds like iThrive is the place to start, and iThrive can help you identify additional resources, including some of the resources Sarah talked about with statistics. So what about the interface between iThrive and the IRB? Does the iThrive also help you to get that IRB protocol together and get it in a form that the IRB is going to be willing to endorse?
So some of the resources we have relate to the regulatory requirements for various types of research. So again, some of the things that are on the iThrive portal include guidances regarding regulation. And the IRB team and the regulatory team have done a beautiful job of creating what are called learning shots, which are very short audio-visual tidbits of information that are relevant to investigators. And so we point a lot of researchers toward resources like that. We can certainly do a consultation with an individual investigator if they need our help, but in addition, the IRB team also offers individual consultation for investigators.
The IRB has a full-time staff in addition to the IRB board. And the full-time staff is available really almost any time to help individuals develop their protocol and can guide them with regard to regulatory guidance as well as sort of process guidance in our own system to help particularly new investigators find their way and come up with a protocol that is likely to be successful. At the same time, our full board, you know, we create our board with the idea of potentially matching the complexity of the kinds of protocols that come in. So we have a very diverse board that includes expertise in lots of medical subspecialties, as well as members of the community, to give a very full and rounded assessment of protocols as they come in. And so individuals, so for example, in pediatrics, could approach their pediatric representative to the IRB to talk about their particular protocol and get their guidance from both a substance standpoint in terms of the science, as well as a process point of view in terms of getting the protocol through the IRB to approval.
What we're hearing about is lots of help, right, for an investigator. Sounds like this also takes a bit of time, though, right? So if I'm thinking about starting a study, you know, I've got lots and lots of energy. I'm going to give it my all, and I got a really important question. I think I can answer it and get some valid results. So how much time should I be leaving myself to avail all of these resources?
More than you think.
I would say that one of the efficient ways that you can get a lot of this help all together, as Sarah mentioned, we have PHS at the library 5 days a week, but 2 days a week we also have the iThrive Research Concierge at the library as well. So it's a nice way to get started to figure out how big your project may need to be and how much planning you need and how many experts you need. Some people come to those and they're pretty well prepared to move forward, and some people come to those at the very beginning of developing their research program, so it can really vary.
Are both of those okay? You can come early on when you just sort of, here's the question I want to answer, but you can also come when things are a little bit more put together.
Absolutely.
And then I would say that it's better to come and chat to statistics sooner rather than later. We have a general rule that we like to hear from you at least 6 weeks before submission deadline, as people tend to react badly if we tell them their design is wrong after a budget is done. So sooner you come to see us, the better.
Yeah, I think I agree completely. These things do take time, and research is complex, and there's lots of different factors to put into place. But I think the time spent up front goes a long way toward really expediting the process and getting to the end result of having a protocol that now you can implement and begin to enroll subjects for. The IRB is available at any step of the way to consult in order to talk about the ins and outs of what a particular protocol might require from a human subject standpoint.
And somewhere along the way, somebody's going to be asking me about the validity of my science. So I assume that if I come asking a question to iThrive to get some help, will somebody give me an answer to a question that I haven't asked? In other words, my iThrive concierge or my statistician may also say, have you considered the following? Because again, if I'm not a very experienced investigator, I may not know what I don't know.
That is a great point, Jim. two of the things that we find most commonly when investigators come to us that they haven't necessarily thought of is how to partner with the community as they start their research program. So we've been helping a lot of researchers think about the community-engaged research component. And then the other piece is something that we're working closely with the IRB on, which is making sure that we're helping the investigators do a feasibility assessment. So if they do start their research program, that we have some data that suggests that it really is feasible for them to complete the program and answer the question they're trying to answer.
Yeah, from the IRB standpoint, we do tend to look at feasibility. And I can tell you that there are many superb protocols that go unfinished simply because the rigor exceeds the feasibility, if you will. There's not that proper balance to really write a protocol that is feasible in our context. And that, from our perspective, is a problem because then you may be putting subjects at risk without finishing the protocol and being able to answer the question.
So I think I'm going to take a stab at trying to summarize some of the things that we've articulated over the last few minutes. So I think the first lesson is that you really want rigor. Rigor is a real thing, and it's really important. And if you want to generate data, results in a study that are really important for advancing health, which is the business we're in, you need to do sound, rigorous human subjects research, starting from the beginning with a really good protocol with amelioration or mitigation of biases and maximizing validity, having good design, having good statistics, all that is important from the start, right? You're not going to get good science at the end if you don't have a good plan from the beginning. The second major point, I think, is that we have really awesome resources available to us through iThrive as kind of the new kid on the block, bringing everything together, but also interfacing with public health sciences and some of the statistical support. And then, of course, the IRB has always been a great partner in developing or delivering great clinical research. But what iThrive brings is a real treasure trove of resources, everything from identifying potential collaborators and helping with feasibility analysis and the study design and helping with identifying funding sources, and then really through every step of the protocol, helping not only to mitigate and overcome challenges, but even identifying what some of those challenges are, investigators may not even know. What have we missed? Anything else people want to contribute? Overall lessons?
Well, I think one of the things the IRB has noticed is the more a particular protocol has been reviewed, in general, the better it is. And so some of the best protocols we see sometimes come from industry simply because of the intense vetting that goes to those protocols. And by the time they come to us, they've been vetted so heavily that they seem pretty tight and pretty rigorous. A new investigator hasn't had that opportunity. So one of the things that we always encourage people is to have other people review their work, review their protocols, including people that know the science as well as those who don't know the science. And we try to bring expertise to the review of protocols, particularly protocols of new investigators, and to give feedback that will help the investigator develop a protocol and a program of research that will be rigorous and that will be sustainable.
Thank you. And maybe the last pearl is start early. Avail yourself of the resources early in the design. Don't do things at the last minute. Take advantage of the resources that we have, but make sure that you give everybody enough time to help you out. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your time. And
pleasure.
I hope this has been valuable, and we hope you tune in for future episodes.